Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
How did the Kraken get its name?
Do you know your dragon from your wyvern?
And how old is the chupacabra?
Here there be monsters and a great deal more, because today we are gazing into the origins of Basilisk, Bigfoot, Siren, and Hydra on this mythical beast and cryptid-themed episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Safaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are talking about mythical beasts and legendary monsters, some of our greatest imaginings in history.
Yeah, but also we're going to talk about cryptids too. And I hasten to add, maybe they do exist. Maybe they're not all in our imagination, but we're going to dive into the names of all of these various creatures, be they real or not. And their names are just as curious as the creatures themselves.
I think we should start by releasing the Kraken, as we may.
Let's get Kraken with the Kraken.
Yes, indeed.
Do puns too.
Should we describe what these things are before introducing the name of the word?
Yeah. So the Kraken first turns up right in natural history descriptions of Norway. So it's like its domain is the coast of Norway. I did find the first sort of famous reference to it, which is from the Natural History of Norway, which wasn't written in English, obviously. It was written by a guy called Pontoppidan. Okay, curiously named. But a very famous name in natural history literature, but I can't pronounce it anyway. And
he's a bishop, right?
Is that right?
The Bishop of Bergen.
Oh, Bergen. I went to Bergen last year. It's a very beautiful place. Coastal town, of course. Very famous in the Hanseatic League, very lovely marina there. So I'm not surprised that this word has, you know, been made famous by someone of that city. And he wrote, among the many great things which are in the ocean is the Kraken. This creature is the greatest and most surprising of all the animal creation.
Indeed, it would be very surprising to find one.
So what is it? It's some giant sea beast that will drag your boats down to the depths if you're not careful.
Accounts vary. Some of them are squid-like, some are not. So it could be inspired by a whale or a giant squid or something like that. And it's mostly accounts from the 1700s onward that associate it with a many-armed animal lurking off the coast of Norway and Iceland, sort of like a giant squid. But the name of it makes sense for that. The word means ultimately a crooked, misshapen tree or a hooked piece of wood. So you can kind of imagine that, like, the roots might resemble a squid or something.
The thing that was a revelation for me while looking up what this meant is a very small fact about the word Kraken, but one that I think is significant because I think it means we should reframe how we name it. It's that the un at the end of it means the. Oh. It's the Norwegian definite article. Yeah, because in Norwegian and Swedish, for example, they don't use the word, a word like the. Instead, they put en or et or ett at the end of words to make the. And the n at the end of Kraken is the definite article in this case. It is. So actually, we should be calling it not the Kraken. We should be calling it the Kraker or the Krak.
Or just Kraken.
Yeah, we're repeating the definite article. Yeah, or just Kraken. Yeah, that's a better way of doing it, actually, Jess. Let's call it Kraken from now on.
That's one of our pleonasms or tautologies that we've talked about before, like the La Brea tar pits is the tar pits.
Oh, yeah, so exactly.
The Kraken is the Kraken.
Yeah, when you realize this about Norwegian and Swedish, you realize, oh, lots of words have got et and n at the end of them. We shouldn't be putting the in front of them.
The notion here is also like something that grabs, right? Its predecessors have also been related to words for hooks and grabbing things and boat hooks and hooked tree trunks. And other historical names have been horven, meaning the harrow, basically sea crake is what it is, and then crab, which all imply grabby things or crab-like claws. This reminds me, there are many sea beasts throughout basically every mythical beast tradition. One of the more famous ones from the like biblical texts is, of course, Leviathan, a gigantic sea serpent or sea monster described in the Hebrew Bible, especially in Job, Psalms, and Isaiah. It's this chaos creature with impenetrable scales and immense strength, and it sometimes breathes fire. And it's one of these like cosmic chaos serpents from a long-standing tradition. Like there are also variations in Mesopotamia and Syria and things like that, but they're not one-to-one. It's this recurring storytelling trope called sometimes in German Chaoskampf, which means the combat myth, which is usually a multicultural mythological motif involving a battle between a cultural hero or a god and then one of these giant chaos monsters. Leviathan in particular also means twisted one or coiled creature. Ultimately, it's a Hebrew word.
So many monsters are depicted as serpents of one form or another, be them flying serpents crawling along the ground or half serpent, half woman. In fact, we should talk about all of those things, and we will talk about all of those things, of course. We should talk about dragons, though, if we're going to talk about like the king of the serpent, right? So the word dragon, what does it literally mean?
The actual literal meaning of it, whether it's a snake or a dragon as we know it now, is kind of debated because this is a Greek word. And in the Iliad in particular, Agamemnon wears a blue, the word is dragon, on motif on his sword belt, but it's just as likely that it was used here to refer to a snake.
Right. And I reckon it goes back to this Greek word, derkesthai, don't they? That means to see clearly. The idea being that it does have this sort of deadly stare that sees to the very center of your soul. And, you know, one glance would be enough to kill you. It's interesting. The word dragon, you know, appears in English from French. So you have this Latin Draco, and it becomes dragon in French, and then we get dragon. But even earlier than the Normans bringing that word over, there are traces of it in English, which is interesting because what it is, it's a direct borrowing by the Anglo-Saxons or whatever Germanic tribes came before them from the Romans, because we have this predecessor to the word dragon that means the same thing, which is a fire drake. Drake being related to Draco. And yeah, Drake in general being a word for a dragon as well.
I think we mentioned before too that it's a little interesting to observe the difference between European dragons and Far East or Chinese dragons, which have more long bodies and mammalian faces. And the word for them, long, is thought to echo the sound of thunder, which I think is very cool.
Yeah, we mentioned how a lot of dinosaurs found in China now are given the suffix long as a sort of nod to the Chinese word for a dragon. But, you know, there's no relation between the European dragons and the Far Eastern dragons. It's just a bit like we were talking about the deep sea creatures and how we have this vast, scary place that we know so little about. So we invent these massive monsters that live there. Well, also, for some reason, humankind wants there to be enormous snakes flying around. And so disparate cultures create very similar creatures. Of course, they were once called worms in English. We should mention this too. An old English word for a dragon was a worm or a wurm. But, you know, that could mean a serpent, right? So the idea is that the early dragons are flying serpents. And so really, when we talk about like an earthworm, hey, there we go. Serpent on the arm of Jess there.
There we go. That's Tolkien's depiction of Smaug, who is described as a wyrm.
Oh, is he?
In the same way. Okay. He's using the Old English term.
Mm-hmm. There we go. He would, wouldn't he?
Yes, he would.
And so them to be reduced to what the earthworm is now, this very, very small, fragile serpent is quite amusing.
Of course, dragons have become a huge part of pop culture too, right? Including Dungeons and Dragons and everything that's spawned from high fantasy. And there is a bit of debate in the nerdier corners of the internet about whether dragons with two legs and wings versus four legs and wings are dragons or wyverns. Oh. Because wyverns, which also appear in medieval heraldry, are typically two-legged dragon-like creatures, sometimes with more animal parts on them. Like sometimes they'll have a snake tail, sometimes they'll have a more mammalian looking face, but typically they have two legs and wings. So some people argue that it's not a dragon if it doesn't have four legs and wings, right. Which is funny because then this came up a lot with Game of Thrones, because the dragons in the show had wings and two legs. So they were like, they're actually wyverns, which wyvern, by the way, it comes from the old French guivre, meaning snake, and is also thought to have doubled for a word for a javelin, and might ultimately be related to viper.
I was looking at a medieval bestiary. I know you love these books that attempt to chart all sort of wildlife, but they also include a lot of what we now realize are mythical beasts. And their drawing in this particular one, which is from the early 13th century, Cambridge University's got hold of it. It's all written in Latin, but their dragon is two-legged with two wings. It's basically a snake with two legs and two wings. And here it is eating something that looks an awful lot like a sort of weirdly snouted elephant. Anyway, they've kind of got shorter as we move through time, haven't they? They've gone from these very sort of long things to something that's a bit more sort of stubby. So hold on. So, for example, on the Welsh flag, you've got a four-legged dragon with two wings. Is that a dragon then, or is that a wyvern?
Supposedly that is, well, according to the, I don't know, nerds that I follow, that would make it a dragon. But is it typically described as a wyvern?
Never.
Okay, good. That's what I was thinking.
Good. Okay. Yeah, I'm just checking.
Good.
I'm just checking.
Good. We're on the same page.
You know, checking our Welsh friends are,
Oh, yeah.
Being accurate.
Wyverns also appear frequently throughout heraldry in this period as well.
Well, actually, in this same book, I also saw the salamander, a drawing of what was described as a salamander.
Yes.
That looked extremely similar to the dragon, but it didn't have wings. And that salamander, it's not the salamander that we think of necessarily, is it? The real world reptile.
Amphibian.
Very good. Okay.
They're squishy.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay. I just didn't know that. Even though I did meet that axolotl, didn't I? I was boasting about meeting an axolotl.
Yeah, you did. That's
didn't,
right.
I didn't even clock. Okay. Yeah. So the salamander of mythology, what's the deal with that? The idea is that it can withstand fire, right?
And it does mean, the word means from fire, which if I recall correctly is from a Persian source, if I'm... This is off the top of my head. But salamanders were also, that type of salamander were used in heraldry. And the word was associated with the heraldry form of a salamander as recently as the past century too, because the word like gerrymander, which we've talked about before from Elbridge Gerry, plus the word salamander, the district he created was supposedly intended to look like a heraldic salamander, a dragon-like thing, rather than an amphibious thing. And the amphibians are named after the mythical ones.
Yeah, because you have this weird disconnect, don't you, between what animals in heraldry look like and what they're called.
Right.
For example, you have lions and leopards. They kind of swap around in heraldry in terms of, you know, what they're named. You'll see a thing and say, oh, that's a lion. They go, no, it's not. It's a leopard rampant or something like that. It gets a bit confusing. And so what we call salamanders, you don't want to stick them in a fire. They're not going to handle it well. Maybe they sort of got their name because they were found sort of crawling out of the ruins of fires, because they like to be inside of logs and stuff like that. But while the fire was roaring, the salamander would have been toast.
The typical discourse is you find a dead, rotted log and the salamander crawls out of it, and therefore it is born from the fire. But it might also just be that they often come in bright colors too. That could have also contributed to the notion that they're not bioluminescent, but they often have like orange dots and things on them, or come in more neon colors, which is neat. But they do appear. You alluded to bestiaries. So we're looking at work by like Pliny the Elder and other works. They predate that by a good bit. There are bestiaries in the library at Alexandria and things like that, but Pliny's Natural History and then other medieval bestiaries, especially Anglo-Norman ones, were a bit of a hobby, and they include both real and mythical animals, but some of the real animals are also ascribed with moral qualities. Like elephants are often considered wise and analogous to man, and lions, of course, are associated with royalty and things like that. But they also include mythical creatures and real creatures with mythical elements to them.
We now have a real world animal called a salamander that's got its name from the name of a mythical creature. It's not the only one, though, is it?
No, there are a number of them. So, for example, I think it would be relevant to talk about the basilisk,
yeah,
which is a figure to which the word dragon has also been applied to basilisks in the past, too. That certainly tracks with the deadly gaze sense of its name. But there are basilisk lizards that are named for basilisks mythologically as well. The basilisk lizard is the one that you see running on water, which is very neat.
Oh, yeah. I love that one.
Mm-hmm. I love the slow-mo of them.
Basilisk being related to other kingly words like basilica and basil as well, because it comes from the Latin, which comes from the Greek, basilikos, meaning, yeah, kingly.
Interestingly, in Pliny's work, the basilisk is an itty-bitty serpent. He's less than a foot long, and his hiss terrifies other snakes, and his trail and breath are fatally toxic, and he has a killing gaze, much like we see in other stories about basilisks. But he's itty-bitty in Pliny's work, which is fun. He usually has a rooster's crest, sometimes wings, sometimes multiple legs, but always kind of snake-like and lethally poisonous.
And it might be that crest that is the reason for the name of basilisk, isn't the idea that it's sort of almost like a crown, which is why they've got this sort of kingly thing. They've got another name though, haven't they? I think it's basically the same animal. It's the cockatrice, right? And I was looking up cockatrice, which is a word that in the past has basically been interchangeable with the word crocodile. So actually that is something that we have in the real world that has a name from myth. Yeah, they're basically alternative renderings of the same collection of consonants and vowels, cockatrice and crocodile. And you can see cockadrill, for example. I think the Latin for a crocodile is cockadrillus.
We've talked about that metathesis before.
Yeah, we made a right mess of crocodile, to be honest. But it's thought that cockatrice comes from Latin calcatrix, which means one who tramples.
You would think that a snake wouldn't be very good at trampling.
You wouldn't, but a crocodile's kind of good at it.
But a crocodile, yeah, could, yeah. You alluded to it, but basilisk literally means little king or young ruler. So we're looking at a kind of little basilisks, but they were called the king of serpents, and in many cases described as if they are real animals.
And then, of course, you've got the thing called the cockatrice, which is what I'm thinking of Tudor banquets that they would serve up. Mm-hmm. That would be a half cock and like a half pig, or something like that, right? But the idea of the cockatrice and the basilisk is that it is hatched from a cock's egg by a snake.
Ah, right. That makes sense.
And that's how you end up with this weird hybrid. Yeah, it's like mummy snake, daddy. But daddy is also mummy because somehow he's managed to lay an egg. Very messed up.
Think about the last time you had a cancel subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Another fun hybrid is a hippogriff, right? The head, wings, and talons of an eagle and the hindquarters of a horse, but it's half griffin. Griffins, as you could probably guess, are named after hooked things like beaks and claws and whatnot, which makes sense because hawks and falcons are also named after their hookiness.
We could talk about animals that are half one thing, half another for the entirety of this episode if we want to.
Yes. The griffin in particular is kind of neat. The first known narrative appearance of a griffin is in a lost poem by Aristaeus, who is a semi-legendary Greek poet and supposed miracle worker. We have excerpts of it in other people's works, but not the whole thing. And the poem, which is called Arimaspia, details his travels in the far north. And at one point, he writes about a tribe of one-eyed people called Arimapsi, known for battling griffins who guard gold in the area and who chill with Apollo in the winter. It's thought that the griffin as a myth is sometimes interpreted as growing from in early encounters with the fossils of Protoceratops in the Gobi Desert in Central Asia, where you find beaked skulls and large quadruped bodies, sometimes with sort of a lion-like thing about them, which is cool.
There's usually something behind these ideas, isn't there? They haven't necessarily been plucked out of nowhere.
Right. It would make sense if someone found, say, dinosaur bones, that they would assume it is or they could put any number of arrangement of those bones together to create a dragon or a griffin or something along those lines.
They're not wrong insofar as it is an animal that is not around anymore.
Close enough, right?
Present day, yeah.
Another cool thing about the hippogriff, by the way, is that they are fairly recent. Like, you would think that they would be as old as griffins, but they're several centuries later. They came from Orlando Furioso, which is a Renaissance work about a knight who encounters a creature born of a union from a griffin and a mare. And of course it means horse griffin.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, now I think about it, I'm not that surprised that it's quite new because it's actually not a particularly clever name. Like, I could invent something like that.
Yeah.
And I did come across another one that sounds kind of benign, which is called a Hercocervus. Do you know a Hercocervus or Hercocervus?
Tell me.
The cervus bit means a heart, as in a stag.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like the French
cerf. That's what I was going to say.
Which means a stag. We believe you, Jess. And the Hircus bit means a he-goat. So it's half goat, half stag. How boring would that be to come across? I mean, of all the things that you
how
could
would you?
Have.
That's like most antelopes.
Yeah. Oh, while we're on goats, no, we should save this for later, but goats are going to come up again when we talk a bit about cryptids.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One animal that did make me smile, and we're talking about sort of slightly rubbish ones, is one that Pliny does talk about, which is the Catablepus. Do you know the Catablepus?
I don't know the Catablepus. It sounds like you're censoring yourself.
No. It's not. It's not called the Catablepus. So Pliny writes about this in Natural History, like you talk about. And he describes it as having a very heavy head, which it carries with difficulty. It is always hanging down to the ground. Otherwise, it's deadly to the human race, as all who see its eyes expire immediately. But basically, this animal is just, its face is so massive and weighty, it can't look up at you anyway.
I love bestiaries. They're so unhinged. My favorite element from a bestiary is the barnacle goose. The notion in the bestiary is that these birds, geese, emerged from crust-covered logs or floated ashore inside shells and barnacles. This excused the eating of goose flesh during Lent because the animals were treated as fish.
I was looking up lists of animal, of medieval beast, and to see the barnacle goose on that list, I was like, what? Why is the barnacle goose on there? Because there is a barnacle goose, you know.
Literally, it's just so you can eat geese at the holidays. Or during Lent.
Very clever. Very clever. Hybrid animals, we should talk about mermaids, really. I mean, it'd be stupid not to give them mention, wouldn't they? Very simple etymology to mermaid is that mer is from, you know, this old English word
sea lady. Mere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it means the sea. In German, it's ever so slightly more specific. Because the German name for a mermaid, it's a Meerjungfrau. The Meer there is the same word. It means the sea. But they're making it quite clear that this is a young lady. So the Meerjungfrau.
Old English also had Meerwief, which was called a water witch, but is a water woman. And then, interestingly, Meermen, but it meant siren. The second element isn't man. It's something else.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because in a lot of languages, mermaids are just called sirens. Like I noticed in French, they tend to call it a siren. In Polish, they call it a siren. And isn't that just getting it wrong? Because sirens and mermaids aren't the same. One of them is half fish and the other one is half bird. They're both hanging around at the sea. And they're both sexy on rocks.
I guess it's the depictions from the Odyssey that are throwing me, because they're often depicted as fish people.
There is no consistency to this, because you also have other characters, specific characters that sometimes described as sirens, sometimes described as mermaids. Sometimes they're described as being half woman, half serpent, sometimes half woman, half fish. You've got Mélusine, for example, is a character from French myth. One of the myths is that she is half person, half two-tailed serpent.
I'm seeing the art here. So we've got from like 370 BC, she's got wings, but then in like a 12th century bestiary, sorry, a 13th century bestiary, we have a more mermaidy looking siren.
Well, I'm looking at this one from 13th century right now, and actually it's the perfect compromise candidate because it has wings and it's got bird's feet, but the tail is distinctly marine and is holding a fish and has a very strange pair of boobs.
Get you a girl who can do both. That's what the lesson here.
The story goes, she marries this guy called Raymond, poor Raymond, who doesn't know that there's anything unusual about her. All he knows is that he's had to promise her he will never see her on a Saturday. Why will he never see her on Saturday? Because a Saturday is bath day. And so one day he breaks the promise. He sees her on Saturday. And depending on the story you read, she basically loses her and she leaves him. It all goes to pot. He's broken his promise. But up until that point, he doesn't know that he's married a half two-tailed snake.
But apparently you have to wash yourself in snake form. So that makes sense. I see that.
Yeah, that's it. He wasn't allowed to see her giving birth. Or I can't remember that. No, that was Mélusine's mum.
They set boundaries. I get it. I get it.
It does make any marriage seem functional, though, doesn't it? When you realize, well, at least I haven't just found out she's half serpent. Although I would say in my more misogynistic moments that... not my wife. Someone else's wife.
Of course not.
I really want to move on. I'm actually blushing with my own sort of casual sexism. there's this other character called Lamia, who was originally just a woman who fell foul of Hera. So, you know, from Greek mythology, Zeus's missus. And so Hera, overreacting as she always does, took Lamia's kids away. And yeah, sometimes also described as then turning her into a half serpent as well.
I think it's worth mentioning the phoenix, which is a very old creature. It first appears in the 8th century BCE when the centaur Chiron, which we can get to centaurs in a second too, explains to Achilles that the phoenix outlives 9 ravens and therefore has an immense lifespan. And that's, of course, by descending into flame and then being born from the ashes. But it pretty much probably means like Phoenician bird, but it also might mean like red or purple bird.
Right.
In Old English, it was spelled Phoenix, which makes perfect sense. But we Hellenified it as Phoenix to match Phoenician.
That's annoying. So the spelling is informed by the spelling of Phoenician. So that if it's wrong that it comes from that, that is a perfect folk etymology.
If that is the case. But it's also inspired by the Latin spelling of it, which was P-H-O-E too. So.
Ah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. I mentioned centaurs, which we should probably address too.
Yeah, and I've noticed a transatlantic difference in pronunciation here because I've never heard an English person call it a centaur. I've only ever heard it as a centaur.
Centaur. I mean, that's how it's spelled, centaur. But we're lazy with our rhoticism.
Right. Okay. So it's like you think it's wrong to say centaur.
I don't think it's wrong. I just think it's American.
Why are you pretending there isn't a U there? What's going on here? Anyway, tell us about centaurs.
It is a Greek word, kenteros, which means to strike, the elements mean to strike or to pierce a bull. So it's a bull piercer or bull fighter, which some linked to mounted hunters in Thessaly that are sort of combined into one person. Most centaurs, which date back to the 8th to 6th centuries BCE, were unruly wine-fueled boulder-throwing mountain dwellers who are half horse, half person. And a major exception is Chiron, who I mentioned. He's a wise centaur who appears in early Greek epics as a tutor to heroes like Achilles and Jason.
Let's talk about another equid, the unicorn.
The unicorn, the one horn.
Yeah, the one horn. Really boring. The only reason I want to mention it, because we also talked before about how German is Einhorn, which is literally like us just calling it a one horn. The French word for a unicorn is licorn. Mm. And I was wondering why on earth that was, because unicorn almost sounds French already, right? And it comes from the Latin.
Because it has that corn bit instead of the horn, so it aligns with Latin cornus.
Yeah, that's worth pointing out. Yeah, exactly. See, cur and her sounds swap around a lot, as we've talked about. But it actually did used to be unicorn in French, or unicorn. But two mistakes happened that meant it turned into licorne. The first one is that the un at the start of unicorn was confused for the indefinite article one, un. So it was thought it was unicorn, right? And so what do you want to do if you want to stick a definite article in front of that?
Oh my God, no way.
Yeah, you call it a licorne.
That's amazing.
Say licorne. And then, so that then gets turned into the full name of the thing. So you end up with un licorne.
I am obsessed with this. Now that's some fun folk etymology stuff too. Yeah. That's very fun.
It's good old fashioned re-bracketing. A la Nada, Numpire, all of these that we've talked about before. Another example of it in French is they call ingots lingot or lingo in French. And that is, again, from le ingo.
I love it.
There we go.
It is, I think, worth mentioning, I think we may have addressed this before, so I'll keep it brief, but unicorn is a Latin translation of the Greek monoceros, which means one-horned. Yeah. Which is the same second element, keris, that appears in like rhinoceros and triceratops. Tops and things like that. That's C-E-R. Literally, rhinoceros, it's nose-horned. So monoceros is one-horned. And the Greek monoceros was a somewhat different mythological creature described by Pliny in his natural history book. His unicorn wasn't just a horse with a horn. It had a horse's body, a deer's head, an elephant's feet, a boar or a lion's tail, and one black horn that was 2 cubits or about 3 feet long, which sounds terrifying.
Yeah. He says it was impossible to capture the animal alive. Ooh. So if you see a unicorn, you better bloody kill it.
I mean, that sounds a little bit like a rhino to me. If you're describing a thing with a horn this long with elephant's feet and a boar or lion's tail, that sounds like a rhino.
Pliny was a Roman though, right? It wasn't Greek, was he? He was Roman.
But he wrote in Greek, often wrote in Greek.
The Romans also applied the word unicorn to, for example, a rhinoceros, right? It was just, if it got one horn, it's fair game to call it a unicorn.
We have been talking about classical creatures from bygone eras who have now become part of like Dungeons and Dragons myths and whatnot. But what about modern mythical and or urban legendy type creatures that some people still believe in and, you know, perhaps maybe real.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Do you know what, one of the big surprises for the research for me was how recent the idea of the chupacabra is, right? Like, it doesn't exist before 1995. 1995! And it's just a name that's come up with by news sources.
That's the name. The modern legend begins in Puerto Rico in 1975, as a matter of fact, with a cluster of livestock killings around the town of Moca that led newspapers to talk about El Vampiro de Moca, the vampire of Moca. Later, in 1995, new killings in other towns reported animals with no blood that were then called by local media, specifically Silverio Perez, who used it on in San Juan Radio in 1995 while joking about the attacks, supposedly. And it means...
goat sucker.
Yes it does. Which makes sense.
Yeah, or sucker goats. Actually, this is interesting. So the cabras at the end, cabras, means it means goats, right? So here's another one of those things where I think we're getting it wrong. Because the original word that was coined is chupacabras as the singular. But what we've done in English is we've knocked the S off the end for the singular, mistaking chupacabras as the word for...
as plural.
The plural of the beasts, when actually it is the plural of the goats that they suck, if you understand what I mean.
Oh! So
it's multiple goats.
Multiple goat sucker.
It's goats mm-hmm. sucker, not that's... goat suckers, chupacabras. Yeah, that's cool. And that cabras is related to lots of other words in English related to goats, like chevron. You know chevron, that... that shape, huh. Yeah? It's because a goat's hind legs are that shape. That's where the word... Yeah, exactly. It's a good
I was going to guess horns. That's neat.
No, yeah, it's their back legs. Have a look up a goat's ass and you'll see, a chevron.
Yeah, cute little tails.
Yeah, obviously a Capricorn as well. It's in there. And also that Spanish insult, cabrón, means big goat.
We should definitely do an astrology episode at some point. I feel like people would really like it.
Yeah, okay.
I know. I understand why you're saying that, but we should. We should probably mention that chupacabras are probably mangy coyotes. They did necropsies on some of the animals that were being attacked, and they were not bloodless, but they had been mauled by some mangy coyotes wild dogs.
Yeah, yeah. So there are multiple descriptions of what the chupacabra is, but the ones where it's like a dog. It's like, well, that was a dog. It was probably a dog.
By the way, these are examples of cryptids, which we have not explicitly said yet, which is a word meaning it's rooted in the word hidden, the Greek word for hidden, and cryptozoology is the study of hidden animals. In Maine, there is a cryptozoology museum, which I highly recommend. It's small but fun.
Is there anything in it? What would you put in a museum of cryptids? We haven't actually found anything yet, but we're hoping to.
You'd be surprised. But one of
you got a stuffed Bigfoot.
One of the main figures in modern cryptozoology is Belgian zoologist Bernard Heuvelman, I think, I just said his name as if it was Spanish. Heuvelman is probably what it is. He's a very interesting person. He escaped from a Nazi prison camp, worked as a jazz singer in Paris, and did have a doctorate degree in zoology. But inspired by Jules Verne and Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World, he also wrote several books on what he called unknown animals. Like a 1955 one included real ones like the pygmy chimpanzee and the coelacanth and the Komodo dragon and the okapi. And in those cases, local people did know about them, but zoologists didn't believe they were real until they saw them. So he wrote about that. And then he also wrote about evidence for cryptids like the ones we know of today, like Yetis and Chupacabras. Well, not Chupacabras, because it hadn't been mentioned yet, but Bigfoots and Sasquatches and things like that. And he wrote about the Mokele Bembe of the Congo Basin, which is basically a sauropod, a long-necked dinosaur that was believed to live in the Congo Basin for a long time.
You mentioned a few of them there. Bigfoot and Sasquatch, are they the same cryptid or are they different?
So... large hair-covered bipedal humanoid forest inhabitants of North America date back to many indigenous traditions. There are lots of stories from different tribes and groups of hairy men, and they have different names in depending on who you ask. We got Sasquatch. The word Sasquatch is older than Bigfoot for this.
So that's a Salish word, I think, which is sort of Pacific Northwest, the United States, indigenous peoples around there. And a quote I'm looking at translated as the hairy mountain men.
Ooh, interesting.
Sasquatch.
Saskets originally was the word, right?
Yeah. I don't know how accurate that translation is, but that's a contemporary translation with the word being adopted into English.
Interestingly, the earliest OED uses of Bigfoot are about real people, and they're a bit funny, like Bigfoot, who is a renowned, quote-unquote, a renowned chief of the Wyandot tribe who derived his name from the immense size of his feet, which was fun.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah, his name is Bigfoot because he's got big feet. Good guy.
Got big hands, got big face, big face. Big feet,
it's a good name.
Of course you are.
10 out of 10 naming. No notes.
Yeah, I mean, they're not terribly creative once you get back to the, you know, the literal meanings of these names. And can we sidestep to Yeti at this point? Clearly very similar sort of idea of this sort of humanid, walking the wild, hairy humanid. And Yeti itself comes from a Sherpa language, as you might expect from the Himalayas. And it's made up of, it's a compound basically of two parts that are variously translated. I don't understand why we don't really know exactly what it translates from. Presumably the Sherpa languages are very disparate and varied. But it's sometimes translated as meaning rocky place and yellow bear together. So basically it means a rock bear, right? So that's what Yeti means. But we have this other name for the same animal, which is the abominable snowman.
Yes, indeed.
Which is a translation of a different term.
As much of a mouthful as the word abominable is, the word is quite old. It means, I want to mention that first because it's the Latin ab, meaning off and away from, and then omen, meaning foreboding. But it went through a bit of an etymological crisis from the 1300s to the 17th century, the spelling abominable was more common due to the folk etymology fueled notion that the word was actually from the Latin phrase abhomine, meaning away from man and therefore like a beast. But it became a word for snow dwelling creatures in the 1920s when British Irish explorer Charles Howard Barry set off on this Everest expedition and he found big tracks, and his Sherpa guides said they must have been caused by the Meto Kangmi, meaning man, bear, snowman.
Yeah, but it was actually a journalist who first coined abominable snowman. It was a guy called Henry Newman, and he apologized for his own translation for it a few years later because, I'll tell you what he wrote. He was a journalist, so he was very good at writing down his thoughts. And he wrote, Kangmi means snowmen, and the word meto, because remember it was Meto Kangmi, I translated as abominable. Later, I was told by a Tibetan expert that I'd not quite got the force of the word meto. It did not mean abominable, quite so much as filthy and disgusting, somebody dressed in rags. So really, it should be like the scruffy, stinky, smelly snowman. If they do exist, I hope they can't hear what we're calling them.
I have read Yeti and even Sasquatch myths that particularly focus on their unpleasant smell too. So I guess that maybe that's part of the lore.
Any more cryptids on your list, Jess?
I have a little bit on the Jersey Devil and then the Loch Ness Monster. So should we try those?
Yeah, I don't know the Jersey Devil. What's the Jersey Devil?
So the Jersey Devil, big around here, is a winged hoofed monster of South New Jersey and Philadelphia, said to haunt the forests and bogs of the Pine Barrens. And typical modern descriptions mix features of a small wyvern, a farm animal, kangaroo-like, dragon-like body, or a horse or goat-like head with horns and leathery bat wings and forelimbs. It does a lot of things. It also has a shrieking, blood-curdling cry, and it's usually treated as this elusive creature that startles travelers and attacks livestock and leaves strange tracks in the snow and the sand. The story behind this centers on Mother Leeds, a colonial woman of the Leeds family, who was a prominent U.S. colonial family for whom Leeds Point in the Pine Barrens is named. And that's where the Jersey Devil lives. She'd already had 12 children, and she was like, damn it, I'm pregnant again. And she curses the 13th child in 1735 and says, let the child be the devil. And the baby is born normal, then sprouts wings and hooves and claws and tail. So it was called the Leeds Devil at first. Ben Franklin helped that happen too, because one of the leads was Titan Leeds, who inherited the almanac printing business from his dad, Daniel Leeds, and he became a rival of Benjamin Franklin, who wrote Poor Richard's Almanac. In 1733, Ben Franklin jokingly predicted Titan's death in Poor Richard's Almanac, and when Titan objected, he kept writing as if Titan were a ghost, which helped this like Leeds ghost notion catch on. And it didn't help that there was a wyvern-like crest on the Leeds almanacs, which made them more monstrous in local gossip. And then it became the Jersey Devil in 1909, when there was this widely reported and intense series of sightings of what was termed the Jersey Devil that became a widespread panic across New Jersey and Pennsylvania, leading to news reports, school closings. Apparently, the Philadelphia Zoo posted a $10,000 reward for it. Not sure on that, though. Apparently, as a result of this reward, a bunch of hoaxes came out, including a kangaroo equipped with fake claws and wings. But it became the Jersey Devil after this 1909 flap, you might say.
Flap. Very good.
Flap. You know. So should we close on Nessie?
Oh, Nessie.
I love Nessie.
Loch Ness Monster. Is there any intrigue in that name? I mean, loch, we know, is a Scottish word for a lake.
And Ness probably means fast moving water or something like that, which is interesting. The lake of the river Ness is what Loch Ness is.
Is that the Norse word Ness, then, that you also get for coastal areas as well? I'm just wondering.
Probably related, but this is Scottish Gaelic. A couple of interesting history pieces about this. There is a 7th century account of a water beast in the river Ness dating back centuries, but it might not be the Nessie that we know now. The first appearance of the Loch Ness Monster, as far as
different monster in there now.
She could be immortal, we don't know. Anyway, yeah,
well, she could be, but, exactly.
Maybe an ancestor or something who appeared again in 1933 when the Loch Ness Monster...
Could be the same species of monster. Okay.
Alex Campbell was a local water bailiff and part-time journalist who wrote about Nessie and then, or about the Loch Ness Monster. And then by the 1940s, that was shortened to Nessie. But the one thing that I think is interesting is that there is also a scientific name for the Loch Ness Monster, and it is Nessiterus rhombopteryx, and it means nest dweller with a diamond-shaped fin. And it was coined in 1975 by naturalist Peter Scott during an attempt to, whether it's a joke or not is unclear, but classify and protect the creature. Conservationist Sir Peter Scott started the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, and he and lawyer inventor Robert H. Rhines, who took a photograph of what is styled to be Nessie's fin, also proposed the binomial Nessiterus rhombopteryx.
Well, on that wonderful collection of syllables, I think it's time for us to descend back into the deep and bring this episode to a close. And by the way, this series / season, however you like to term them, because I don't know if you know, so we do these in chunks of 10 and then we just take a couple of weeks off and then we come back. Don't you worry, we'll be back. But this has been a really fun season and a really fun episode to end it on too.
We'll see you in the new year on Words Unraveled.